Welcome to Amazon Legends, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became power sellers. Also providers specializing in helping sellers, aggregators that acquire sellers, and former Amazonians will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here is your host, Nick Urison.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. My next guest today wears multiple hats in e-commerce space. And that includes being a board member, advisor, and equity holder. And he lives and breathes e-commerce. What happens to be one of his passions. So we're going to hear a lot of his work. And he is today the founder of Scale Strategy, which is a full-service Amazon agency and also serves on the board of Marketplace District, which provides the backend to help U.S. sellers to launch in European marketplaces. And when he's not working, he likes to play golf and go skiing and spends time with his three crazy boys. So with that, everybody, welcome to the show, Dan Mazaris.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, great to have you, Dan. So tell me something. When you and I talked about, doing the recording, you mentioned something I've heard for the first time. So tell us.
Okay. Yeah. So something that our agency is doing that we're actually finding quite a bit of success with right now is how to utilize Google AdWords to push traffic to Amazon right now.
So Google AdWords. So first of all, there's a few aspects of this. So I just want to, for listeners' benefit, if you're bringing external traffic to Amazon, Amazon likes that because it's traffic that's coming in. And then, for brand registered sellers, you can enroll in the brand referral bonus and then use attribution. So absolutely, these are things that you have to have as, if you like, prerequisites if you're going to drive external traffic. So when you do this with the brand referral bonus, you get a percentage of the sales you generate back from Amazon, right?
Absolutely. You certainly could drive external traffic from other sources like Google to your Amazon listings without any of that if you want it. But there's absolutely no benefit and no way of tracking. The brand referral bonus is not only people say 10% discount. We need to make sure that's clear. It's not a 10% discount. It is taking your referral fee from 15% to 5%. So it's like a 66% discount on your referral fee to Amazon. But having the brand referral fee not only gives you a monetary incentive to do it, but also you're able to have brand attribution links, which help with tracking whether or not it's actually driving eyeballs and conversions to your listings.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is the bottom line. If you're going to do something, you want to make sure that you maximize the benefits of it. So The setup that we just discussed is the machinery, if you like, you're putting in place where you are tracking where the traffic is coming from, specific to the origin of it, as well as benefiting from the sales you generate from that external traffic. And that is what you said is exactly. It depends on the category, but generally, it's around 10%. So if you drop traffic from Google or your email or from your influencers, and those you can see separately with the attribution tags, and then you say, okay, I generated $10,000, Amazon will give you back $1,000.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great. Okay, now that we established that, tell us, how you leverage Google AdWords so well?
Yeah, good question. So maybe if it's appropriate to do a little story time for illustration purposes of how we kind of started to go down this road, because it honestly started as a test and then the test went really well. And so we've just decided to replicate that over our clients. So the test that we did, particularly this was for a client who sells the self-closing toothpaste caps. The USP there is like, hey, you don't have to worry about your toothpaste caps and you don't have to worry about the mess. Put it right on your toothbrush and then you set it down. It closes itself up and you don't have to worry about anything after that. Interesting product, not a high cost point, price point, which is an interesting point that we can come back to at another time when, if we want to get further into the weeds about like understanding your unit economics and how much you should allocate towards, how much of your marketing budget you should actually allocate towards external traffic, we can get into that. But anyway, not a high price point, almost no barrier to entry for this product. Anybody could really sell it. And so we needed ways to help them cut through the noise. And so we decided, hey, why don't we just try some external traffic? And then it came down to deciding what we wanted to do. And because you could do that through Instagram, you could do it through TikTok, you could do it through Google and anything. And we decided to look at Google AdWords first. And we made this really silly discovery, which is there is a relatively good sized subset of the American consumer that searches for products on Amazon, but uses Google to search for those products on Amazon. So they're literally going to Google and typing in, for example, if you were looking for a water bottle, they'll type in water bottle Amazon. Like they won't just go to Amazon.com and search for it, which you'd think would be intuitive. They just search for it in Google. These people happen to be in the older demographics of the US. So it makes sense. Like the people who are calling you to ask how to make a PDF are the people who are probably typing into Google, water bottle Amazon.
By the way, those people have money.
They do. They have money. And so when we made this discovery, we actually mimicked our keyword strategy on Amazon that we were using with our sponsored products and all the traditional advertising. We mimicked that keyword strategy over to Google, but just tagged Amazon onto the back of each of the keywords to see. And obviously we can look at Google keywords and say, okay, there's some here that make sense and some that we'll eliminate. But at any rate, we mimicked those over to a Google AdWords campaign, all driving through a brand attribution link. And it started doing really well. Like because if you think about it, the purchase intent on those keywords is so ridiculously high. If they're looking for a very specific product with Amazon tagged on it, and you give them a well-reviewed Amazon product that fits exactly what they're looking for, they're going to add that to the cart. So the conversions just started going crazy, and the results were really fun to watch.
Oh my God. I mean, why are you sharing this?
Because I've made a lot of money in my day giving away my ideas.
Listen, this is, you know, I love this strategy, but there is one thing I don't like about it, and that you're making Google rich all the time, and as if like these people. I mean, I'm not against I'm an entrepreneur, so we are all here to make money, but Google of all companies. I have a bit of a thing about Google because it's their way. But anyway, I mean, it's a great strategy. Great strategy. Yeah. So can you share with us some numbers, like what you are experiencing in terms of the traffic conversion and things like that?
Yeah. Good question. So specifically for this example here, one of the funnest things to track was the BSR of the actual product. There isn't a category specifically for toothpaste caps on Amazon. And so we actually have them slotted in the toothpaste category. And within that BSR, they, before we started this, they were in the very, very high hundreds. So pages and pages and pages deep within search results, except for on those extremely relevant keyword terms to them. Within a few weeks of running these Google ads, they launched up onto page one. They were the number three spot in the entire category of toothpaste. So if you pulled up the toothpaste category on Amazon, you'd see like Crest, Arm & Hammer, this scent, all these big, huge Procter & Gamble brands, and then a toothpaste cap on the search results page amongst all of that, which did a ton for not only their organic sales, but it became a recommended product frequently bought with, attached on all of the Crest listings, attached on it. So we went on that unit from selling 20 units a day to 350 units a day within a couple weeks, which created an inventory problem for us because we weren't, like I said, we were just like, hey, we're going to test this. And the test went really well. Luckily, they had enough in their warehouse that we were able to backfill and sustain those sales. That's kind of an example of some of the results. But we're seeing very similar results for our other clients as well that are driving external traffic. It's a verifiable fact now that external traffic makes part of Amazon's A12 algorithm is what we're thinking right now. There's about 12 points that the algorithm's looking at, but it increases every year, it seems.
So what I want to know is, as you know, you rank for keywords and then you put those keywords in your content and then run your PPC campaign. And based on your performance under those particular keywords that have been searched and then ended up buying, you rank.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But when you drive external traffic, there is no keyword search. You're landing directly on the product page. So what is your take on it? Because we don't know, because Amazon algorithms, nobody knows for sure. But what is your take on ranking for specific keywords on external traffic?
Yeah, you bring up a good point, as well as one minor tangent that I'd like to make, because it's very relevant to this point, is there used to be a day where you could do two-stage URLs that were keyword rich. Amazon has since completely crushed that and listed that practice as a black hat tactic under their rank manipulation policies. So for any listeners out there who have heard some online guru say, hey, you can rank on the first page on Amazon with two-stage URLs, run away from those people immediately because you can get your account banned and shut down. So that's not the question you asked, but I did think it was a good point to bring that up. But the question you asked is, what do I think about how it ranks? We don't know exactly how it what percentage it impacts the organic ranking of the products, but what we're seeing is that it does have a natural lift almost everywhere. I think what Amazon is doing is they're looking at, does this brand spend money off of the website to send traffic to our website? If so, we're going to give them a natural organic boost to all of the keywords that we determine are relevant for them. So what's important for the brands to know is index for as many keywords as you possibly can in the early days. But then as soon as you hit that point where it's important to have some redundancy and focus down on those keywords, do it, because your external traffic will take all of those relevant keywords and increase their organic rank. I wish I could tell you exactly this much, but I can't.
No. I mean, look, this is true. So what I heard you say that to me is really the definition. The keywords that they think are relevant to the
listing. Yes.
They all get a boost.
Yes. So you've got to do your due diligence on the SEO side to make sure that you're telling Amazon what you're relevant for, and then also having a good PPC strategy in place on Amazon to make sure that Amazon understands exactly what keywords you are relevant for.
Okay, and then those keywords get a lift once you start driving external traffic.
Correct.
Okay, so I have another question for you, because this is something I'm sure you've heard. It's a bit of a dilemma for people who want to drive external traffic. So as you know, conversion rate is one of the top determining factors for ranking.
Yep.
So you work very hard to get your conversion high. You work on your pictures, you work on your bullet, your A+, and you run your PPC campaign specifically for those keywords that you want to dominate, blah, 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 all those things. All for the purposes of, okay, if I get somebody to search under this keyword and I bring them to my page, then I'm going to get the sale.
Correct.
Because it's relevant and I have a good product, blah, blah. Now comes the external traffic. Not necessarily all buyers. Of course, the example you gave, clearly they're supposed to bring buyers. But
yeah,
talking now, driving external traffic in general.
Yeah.
So Amazon, people on Amazon already, they are on Amazon because they want to buy a product. So when they see an ad, they go, they're likely to buy if it's a good fit for them. But when you advertise on Google, those are not necessarily all buyers. So you start driving this external traffic. Traffic comes to the page. As yet, because not all of them are buyers, they don't buy. And then your conversion rate takes a
plummets. Yeah.
And as a result, you lose your ranking. So I've heard people say, yeah, we tried external traffic, but it completely destroyed our ranking. And then we switched it right off. So.
Yep.
Tell me about your experience, your thoughts.
You are exactly correct in that driving a boatload of traffic to your listing, if it doesn't convert well, it can have a negative impact. That's exactly why our strategy has been highly focused on just mimicking keywords that have Amazon tacked to the back of it. So we're specifically targeting individuals who are searching for products on Google that they want to buy on Amazon. So we make sure that the purchase intent stays high. Now, how does this strategy extrapolate into other channels such as TikTok, Instagram, et cetera, et cetera? Because the same thing could happen on TikTok. You could have a TikTok where a certain product is seen go viral and all of a sudden tons of people are searching for it on Amazon, and the same scenario happens. We make sure that with our TikTok strategy, we try, this is going to sound counterintuitive, we try not to do brand attribution links with TikTok. We try to stage UGC style content. So just for a quick cap to the listeners, you've probably all heard UGC style content before. But for a recap, for those who are listening, basically just like a mom or somebody holding their phone and pointing at themselves and just talking about a product, it looks really underproduced, but it looks very natural and authentic. So placing UGC content, just chatting about the product and giving them an affiliate link instead of a brand attribution link, because Amazon sees the traffic from an affiliate differently than it sees traffic from a brand attribution. They see that as, oh, this is an influencer who is promoting the product, so there will be hits on this link. We're not going to impact your organic ranks because of that.
I see. So that means you need to have an affiliate account.
You need to have a relationship with the influencer. Have the influencer sign up as an affiliate and get their own Amazon affiliate link.
Okay. You know, you hold it back. So you're telling this story, oh, you know, and then I'm thinking, okay. And then there is a whole different machinery behind.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So let's spell that out. So you need to have an influencer,
mm-hmm.
generate content for TikTok.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, you need to have that influencer sign up as an Amazon affiliate and then make sure that that influencer provides that affiliate link with your content.
With their content that they're deploying. Yep.
Yeah, the content that they produce. And then that's what drives traffic to Amazon. And Amazon favors that over attribution.
I wouldn't say favor. They just look at it. They look at it differently. They look not necessarily. They just look at an affiliate link as this is an influencer who is driving traffic. So there's going to be an inflated amount of individuals that come from this link here. And so it doesn't impact your conversion rate as much. Saying if your conversion, if that influencer's TikTok goes viral, and all of a sudden, you get a massive influx of traffic to your listing, Amazon's not going to ding you as much for that.
I see. Okay. So now because it's an Amazon machine, Amazon affiliate system is an internal system, so to speak. So therefore, if you have a surge that really doesn't yield much results, then they're not going to worry about that, and they're not going to let you take a hit for it.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just thinking, why wouldn't you use that strategy? I mean, of course, there's the brand referral bonus situation. Uh-huh. But you're not going to know where the traffic is coming from, right?
Well, you will, because the affiliate link is unique to that influencer, the influencer is able to see exactly how many conversions come from that affiliate link because they're getting a commission. So you're able to see exactly who converts from that.
Influencer to tell you what that is.
Yep. If there's one thing I emphasize the most about influencer marketing, it's that relationship matters more than anything.
Yeah.
You can't just like ask a person, hey, can you post this? Like, you need to go through the process of getting to know who that person is, who that influencer is. Hey, test this product out for a little bit. Did you like it? What feedback do you have? Like, build an actual working relationship with them about the product, because you want to be able to speak back and forth with them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, if you are looking to have somebody to be your fan and talk about your product, it's not going to happen just because you ask casually. They're going to have to. I had a gentleman on the show. He was an influencer, and he had several podcasts. And his biggest tip was get someone who feels passionately about your product to be your influencer.
Yeah.
So passion is the driver there. So otherwise, and then of course, if you get the right people, then you can build that kind of a relationship.
If they're passionate about your product, you won't have to pay them as much. I'm launching a brand right now. We're in the very early stages. That's perfect for parents, particularly moms. Our target market is moms. And so we've put a big focus on just finding the moms who love the product. We're sending it to them for free. And then those who react really well to it, then we come in and ask, hey, is this something that you wouldn't mind posting on your channels? And oftentimes they'll be like, oh yeah, I'll just post tomorrow. And we didn't have to pay them anything. And they'll just post for free.
Yeah. So what is it? We started on Google AdWords, but we're going, I mean, it's e-commerce. Like, it has so many parts. So what is the right kind of number of followers that
would
make the influencer worth engaging?
Yeah, so now we're kind of branching into a different world. So I like to look less at number of followers and more at engagement rate. So likes, comments, shares, etc. Because you can have an influencer who has tons and tons and tons of followers, but their engagement rate has kind of fallen off because their audience is just so big. And when their audience gets really big, they develop an audience of what we call lurkers, which are just people who are like, yeah, I like this person and I like their content. They just kind of watch from a distance, but they're not actually engaged with it. So I like to look for influencers with good engagement rates, because that's going to be better. Those are the audiences who are actually like, oh, they're really like dialed in on, I love everything this person is saying. I love their style. I want to buy what they're using on their hair. I want to buy what they're using on their face. I want to buy what they're eating. Those are the kind of audiences that you're looking for.
So, of course, in order to have that kind of an engagement with an influencer, the audience would have to be small.
Not necessarily. I know, typically smaller followings are more engaged, but I know influencers who have six figures of followers, but their audiences still really love them.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, they build themselves up to be, you know, someone who's all over the place and their material is good. I guess these days, I mean, also in the world of TikTok, where, you know, there's all the thoughts about, you know, what's behind TikTok, and it's all geared towards making the American public dumb enough so that you never know what kind of content is attracting people. So I guess anything would be good. Well, this is great. So Dan, let's talk a little bit about metrics. So you have passion for e-commerce. You serve on the board. You built businesses. So tell us, for the sellers, what numbers should they be watching?
Yeah, especially in today's world, because obviously the world has changed quite a bit over the last 3 years. The number one thing I advise everybody is know your unit economics. If you do not know your unit economics, you are going to get killed. So unit economics, I actually have it written down here. Let me grab it real quick. Oh, maybe I left my notebook because I have a formula that I use. Yeah, my notebook I left. Darn it. I'm not in the office today. I'm at home hanging out with my dog who's just sleeping next to me. But so I have a formula that I use to calculate my unit economics and give me what I call fuel profit, which is the amount of money that I'm willing to spend to acquire a new customer. But it's a formula broken down that equates not only your MSRP and all of your costs, but also your customer lifetime value and your average order volume. These are all really important numbers to understand how much you're willing to spend to acquire a customer and how much they'll be worth to you in the future. Because I think in the olden days, I mean, just a few years ago on Amazon, it used to be a channel where you could list your products. And if you did pretty good with the creative and you did pretty good on SEO, you could just drive a lot of volume and you didn't have to pay a ton of attention to profitability because the sales and the money just kind of flowed. Mm-hmm. Those days are gone. You have to know really, really well your unit economics, not to sound like a broken record here, to understand how much profit you're willing to spend to acquire the customer. And that'll inform the rest of your strategy.
So what is the principle behind it? So let's walk through. So let's start from the top line. So you're selling an item for $100, let's say. Mm-hmm. And you know you're going to spend $15 on Amazon commission.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to spend I don't know, $100 item is likely to be a little bit on the big side. Your FBA fee, you never know. I mean, if it's small, and it, let's also assume round number 15% on FBA fee. So another $15 for fulfillment.
Yeah.
You know you're going to spend money on advertising, and that's not considered the launch, but let's consider the long-term takeoff. Mm-hmm. And then let's say that you're doing pretty well. You've done your homework. You've optimized. You targeted well, blah, blah. And then let's say you are averaging, again, for the round number, 15%.
Okay.
So now we spent $45 out of the $100 sale. So that leaves us with two things. How much money we want to put in our pocket after every sale, and how much we want to spend buying the merchandise landed here.
Yep. What's your COGS?
Yeah.
And then also the things that a lot of sellers don't look into is what is your, you know, your unit cost into Amazon fulfillment centers. So once it's landed at your warehouse, maybe you go direct, maybe you go direct from your supplier to the warehouse, or maybe not. Maybe you go supplier, port, warehouse, FBA fulfillment centers. Like, you need to understand your unit cost at every single touch point there. So COGS, freighting, and then this is less relevant in Amazon, but really relevant in traditional e-commerce is transaction fees. Like if somebody's purchasing with an American Express or whatever, like you're gonna get hit. And so before you know it, you're looking at that profit number. And it's getting squeezed and squeezed and squeezed, and your fuel profit is really at the end of the day on a $100 item. You probably have $20 to acquire a customer, maybe, if you're lucky and you don't want to make profit. Probably $20 to $25 would be my guess. So
that would be on the low side.
Yeah. I would guess $20 to $25 of money left over that you could use either to acquire customers or put in your own pocket or something like that. That's traditionally what I would expect.
Yeah. So as far as how much you can afford to spend to acquire a new customer, does that include the advertising that you factored in, or it's outside?
Well, yeah, so that's that good point there. Like if we're using just Amazon, then obviously your tacos is going to be what we would factor in for your advertising costs. That largely depends on what stage you are in your business, whether you're a new launch or you're focusing on hyper growth or you're focusing on profitability. Like those numbers will vary. So considering that we're factoring in tacos, you'll probably have larger numbers to use for profitability or to go send to off Amazon traffic to try and acquire customers that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. I mean, it's a tough game to play because these numbers, they disappear very quickly. And, you know, the sad part, I'm sure you've come across this, most sellers don't make this calculation.
Yeah. A lot of sellers just look at, okay, what do I land it for in the US? What can I sell it for? And then let's just do advertising because it's a necessary evil. And that, like, that's about as much thought as they're putting into it.
Right.
You've got to get more granular. It's annoying being a bean counter. My personality is definitely, I'm not a bean counter. I have a bean counter on my team that helps. I'm much more of like the visionary big idea type of guy. And then we have other people who help me focus on the details. It's annoying, but it's so, so important to know your costs at every step of the product lifecycle so that you can understand what is your cash conversion cycle from the time you place the down payment on the PO to get the inventory to the time that that turns into cash back into your pocket. What is that cash conversion cycle? Because that can kill or juice your business.
Well, I have another thing that I want to ask you that I'm sure you've come across. A lot of people don't even know how to calculate margin. So for the benefit of the listener, so if you buy something for $100,
mm-hmm.
and then you mark it up 40%.
So your COGS is $100?
Your COGS is $100, and then you mark it up 40%.
Okay.
And sell it for $140.
Yeah.
Your margin is not 40%, is it?
No, you're done. you're losing. You're hemorrhaging cash.
You are hemorrhaging. But that's what some people think. So, you know, it's unfortunately, a lot of money is lost this way. But what you buy for and then how much you add on, that's not your margin. Your margin is whatever your profit is,
yeah.
divide by your sale, you know, your sale price. And that's the margin, because that's what everything comes out of. It's your, whatever you sold, a piece goes to merchandise, a piece goes to Amazon, a piece, and then whatever you're left with. And the other one is not really the way to go about it. I had I never forget. I had a client. Actually, he was my very first client in Argometrics.
Mm-hmm.
After I sold my Amazon account, so we're doing this is like 2 months, 3 months into working together, and we're looking at numbers. And then I calculate the margins, whether it's the advertising or it's the merchandise, or I just put the percentage right next to it. And then he asked me, why do we have these percentages? I said, that's your margin. And then he started to tell me, well, but you calculated all wrong. And then that's how he was running. For 9 years, he had run his business buying it so much, marking it up, and then thinking that's his margin.
Assuming that was his margin? Wow. I'm surprised he survived 9 years.
Because what happened was it was an extremely niche space. Mm. And they launched on their website. He wasn't on Amazon. They launched on their website and they did a good job with Google. And Google ranked them all over the place. Like they were all over the place on page one and driving tremendous amount of business. 5,000 plus SKUs. Each page was hand built. No database.
Wow.
No nothing. If they had to change pictures or add content or whatever, they had to go into the page, into HTML and change it. So anyway,
one
was Google comes along, changes their algorithm, they lose their rank and they take a major hit. And then Google comes along a little bit later and says, okay, everything has to be mobile friendly. Then they're going to lose entire Google. So they had to change every single page by hand to make mobile friendly. So
that
was the interesting story. So
well, it's funny that you bring up Google changing everything, forcing them into stuff. That's the scenario we're facing right now with the current macroeconomic landscape. It's forcing e-commerce sellers to no longer calculate margin by what do we mark it up by. Like you've got to be smart. You got to be smarter now, otherwise you're gonna get killed.
So let's talk about demand planning, which I'm sure you love, because that's everything, right?
As a bean counter, I love demand planning.
So how do you know how much to buy? And just give us the big picture for an Amazon, because this can get very complicated, as you know. But for someone who's doing good business, but they're not really into all that stuff so detailed, give us your take on how to go about planning your inventory.
Good question. I'll be completely honest. I'm not the most, I'm not the exact right person to ask about this question. I've been lucky throughout my career to have amazing demand planners supporting our operations effort, because like you said, that is such a key piece to Amazon, is like once the machine's running, the number one rule, the first commandment of Amazon is don't run out of inventory. And the second commandment is like unto it, don't run out of inventory. How to calculate exactly what you need, that is very hard to know, because it's going to be specific to your supplier. What are their lead times into the US? So the really, really oversimplified answer, and every single talented demand planner would tell you that this is the bare minimum, is the way I like to look at it is never have less than 45 to 50 days of inventory in Amazon fulfillment centers. Now, there's lots of things, like I said, that could impact that. What's your lead time from your factory to the US? Because that's going to impact where you need to reorder the product and how much of the product you need to reorder. Then, as we've seen through 2020 and through 2022, and even going into these years, is into 2023, is Amazon likes to toy with our inventory limits a lot. Sometimes they give you more, sometimes they rip it back. And so it makes a demand planner's job extremely difficult to really pinpoint exactly how much you need. So I wish I could give you a better answer of like, this is exactly how I would do it. But the only thing that I could say is have 45 days of product in Amazon at all times.
Yeah. I mean, I typically, so this is just what I usually tell my clients is, look, you have to plan for how much you need to have at Amazon, and you need to plan for how much you need in your home base to replenish Amazon. So yeah. It's two different numbers. Don't mix the two together. It gets confusing, but make sure that you know how much you need to have all together in your home base so that you can keep replenishing Amazon. And I tell people that to start off with the mindset that you are going to watch the numbers every day and then replenish, send an FBA shipment every week.
Yeah.
And you may not need to send every week, but look at the numbers every day and then be prepared to ship every week. And then you can drop it to every other week. Then you're carrying a little bit more, so on and so forth. So it's a hard job, and it's something that, you know, without inventory, you got nothing, right?
Yeah, we have an inventory planning software that we've built in house by teams that are much smarter than I am, and we look every single week, every Monday, at every single SKU that is under our watch and make FBA shipments accordingly based off of what needs to be shipped. So it really takes that level of detail. Pay that much attention to it, because you're going to need to. What else was I going to say about inventory management? Slipped my mind. I had another thought. If it comes back, I'll grab it.
So some key metrics that you monitor with the Amazon operation in general. So what are some things that you're looking at?
Yeah, depends on the stage of the business. But in general, where the things that we're monitoring the most is keywords. What are the keywords that are most relevant for our products? Are we indexing for them? What's our organic position on them? What is our advertising position on them? And then we're looking at everything that, thank heavens, Amazon has started providing this data, is how many impressions, click-through rate, add to carts, and purchases, which can be found in the brand analytics. Understanding that. And then understanding unit economics. How much profit are we making, and how much of that profit are we willing to give up into more customer acquisition, whether it be through the Amazon platform or from off Amazon traffic to Amazon? Those are the key things that we have to be laser focused on all the time.
How about conversion rates?
Yeah, so that's part of the add to cart purchases. So impressions, click-through rate leads to add to carts, leads to actual purchases. So how much of those people who clicked in added to the cart, how many of those added to the cart actually checked out? That's your conversion rate. So we're monitoring that very closely.
So you're describing the search query performance.
Yes.
So search query performance is per keyword.
Yep.
So, but not the whole thing.
Yeah. You can obviously look at the entire picture in terms of like detail page views versus how many people actually check out from that. Yes. But we're also looking at it at a keyword level at the search query performance report.
Yeah. So there are three things. Tell me what you think about this. So there are three things that I always recommend that sellers keep an eye on at SKU level, as well as overall, as their overall performance, like how much gas you have in your tank and things like that every hour. So one of them is their overall conversion rate and at SKU level. So how is this SKU converting? And you can break this down into organic, total, and external. Or organic, paid, and external. So therefore, it gives you the total. So, and then you can see how that SKU is performing for organic and for your PPC campaign and et cetera. So if you have an overall conversion rate of X, that tells you something. And then also I say this number is not a number that you look at, you know, download report here and there. That's not the idea. The idea is to look at it over time. So how you are trending over time with your conversion rate at SKU level and overall. The second data point is, what is your average traffic? So what is how much traffic are you getting? Again, at SKU level, as well as total. And then you can have an average per SKU, however many listings. And then over time, you know, it's going up and down. And again, you can break that down into organic, paid, and external. And the third one is buy box retention, especially your demand planning. If you have achieved a buy box retention rate of 65%, your unit sales that month may have been 100 pieces. The month before may have been 110 pieces. And if you don't know the buy box retention rate, you don't factor that in. You don't really know the market size.
Yeah.
So things like that. So I always say, keep an eye on that. And the final one is your average order value. What is your average order value? Is it, how is it trending at SKU level as well as overall company-wide? So those four numbers are the numbers that I'd like to look at, you know, over time, constantly checking. And then of course, you know, take cost is obvious. So those are things that you look at. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I really like those numbers as, like you said, like the high level overall picture of your e-commerce health. It's not to say that the other metrics, like you said, tacos, like that's a really important metric for your advertising manager to know really, really well. So we're not discounting at all the importance of those metrics, but yeah, that's a good way of looking overall at the health of your Amazon account. What's interesting for us is I would say buy box percentage is a little bit less important for us, but that's because the purpose of any brand that we bring on or brands that we work with are that they are the only seller. Like that's our goal, is to work with them. If they're a brand that hasn't really controlled their distribution on Amazon, and so they do have a lot of sellers, like the first few months of our engagement is us getting them to the point where we're removing all of those sellers off of their Amazon account so that they can have full control. Because a grand majority of our clients, they have buy box percentages of 99, 100% because they're the owners of their destiny. And that's the goal that everybody who wants to sell on Amazon should have. Any brand out there that is thinking about going to Amazon to sell, if you have not controlled your distribution to this point, get it under control first. Otherwise, you are just going to cause yourself hours and hours and hours and multiple six figures of headache down the road if that distribution isn't controlled.
It's true. It's a lot of people, they attack, you know, B2B orders to get POs and blah, blah. The next thing is, so, okay, let's also sell on Amazon. Let's sell on the website. And then the next thing is they are competing against their own resellers or people who have no idea, and there's the gray market. But then you left out one piece on the buy box. So the part is that is the most under the radar as yet major source for bleeding. You lose the buy box even though you are the only seller. Many times.
Yes, that could happen. But usually, if you lose the buy box and you're the only seller of your product, it is definitely for a diagnosable reason. Instead of in the other scenario where it's just multiple sellers, it's usually just a price war where everybody's just racing to the bottom. At least in this case, if you're the only seller, it's a diagnosable reason, whether it's like, oh, you're missing some kind of documentation, or there's a performance notification on your account, or there's something here and there. At least we can identify it really quickly and remedy the situation really quickly.
Well, what happens is, this is what I see quite a bit, is first of all, people don't know that they lost the buy box because they feel that, oh, we are the only seller, we have no resellers, so why should we must be on the buy box. And then we pull the reports, we look at it, it's 65% last month, 75% the month before, and they don't know. So and now they are in the buy box today, so they don't even know what happened, and that problem may come back. So my experience is, first of all, your return merchandise, Amazon may end up selling it as Amazon warehouse, which means they remove the buy box, there is no more buy box. How much of the time is that happening? The second reason is you may have reduced your price, or you may be selling it on Walmart or somewhere else at a different price, and Amazon will yank you off the buy box so quick and never let you get back in, because as you know, it takes time to incrementally increase and finally have it. So things like that. So what does that mean? What I usually find is it plays right back to your planning. And if you don't have those numbers, your buy box rates, it's something that you need to factor into your calculations.
Yeah. And you bring up another good point, which is like, it could be a whole other podcast episode, which is pricing strategy. If you're an e-commerce brand that intends on selling in multiple platforms or into brick and mortar retail, which is one of the brands I built, did multiple seven figures in brick and mortar retail, their own Shopify store, and high nine figures on Amazon. And so having a pricing strategy in place that allows you to serve each of your channels in a way that keeps Amazon happy.
Right.
Because the unfortunate reality is they don't play nice. If they're mad, then good luck. Like that's a whole other episode right there, is just talking about pricing strategy.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I totally agree. It's a sensitive thing. It's a delicate decision to make. You're going to have both wholesale and retail. And you need to really plan. You need to put the policies in place, get the agreement signed and everything else. Definitely stay on top of the buy box. Either way, if you are the only one, still you want to make sure it's there all the time. And if not, then you need to decide who it is that you're fighting against. So this was great, Dan. So let's get to know you a little bit. So tell us, where did you grow up? Bring us up to date.
Yeah, I have lived in almost my entire life in Utah. Was born in Ogden, grew up in there, but have lived now for the last 15 years in a town called Logan. So I call Logan home. But I also lived for a few years abroad in Italy, which is how I got connected with this marketplace Distri company that I'm now on the board of advisors for. Was with my Italian connection there. They're based out of Lucca, Italy. Beautiful city. Everybody go there. Grew up here in Utah, but love my European adventures as well.
So when was it that you realized you were an entrepreneur?
Oh, good question. I was working for a company here in Utah that it was my first job out of college. I studied marketing and was like, oh, hey, I'll go get a job. And I got a job, and this was a betting company, and they said, hey, go figure out Amazon. And we figured out Amazon, and we built on Amazon at that company what was at the time the largest brand in the entire home and kitchen space. It was a conglomerate of brands. We launched a few brands on Amazon and built that to the tune of very, very high nine-figure numbers on Amazon, selling mattresses, sheets, pillows, anything you can think of. And it was when I saw all of that happening, I realized why am I doing this for somebody else? I could do this on my own. Like I could get products, I could sell them on Amazon on my own. And I also have the skill set and expertise that I could sell the service to somebody else as well. There was just a little bit in me that realized like the nine to five just isn't my jam, and I'm gonna get out of there. So,
well, did you have any inklings of this entrepreneurial thing when you were growing up as a kid?
It's funny. Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, like when you bring up a good story that warms my heart a little bit, because it brings up my mother into things. But she asked me when I was a young boy, I was 7 years old. She said, what sport do you want to play? And I told her golf. Tiger Woods was really big. And so it's like, I want to play golf. I want to be like Tiger. But I grew up in a pretty poor family. And she was like, that's an expensive sport. So I can't, like, you can't play golf unless you pay for it yourself. And so as a 7-year-old, I was like, okay, what can I do to make money to play golf? And so I went and got a paper route, and I delivered papers around my neighborhood every single morning at 6 a.m. I woke up at 6 a.m. every morning as a 7-year-old, walked around the neighborhood, delivered newspapers to make money to buy my first set of golf clubs. And then I used that money to buy my first golf lessons. And of course, my parents supported me where they could, because they were amazing and supportive parents. But I knew She said, really, like, why do you want to play golf? And as a 7-year-old, I told her, Mom, because every business deal is done on the golf course. And that was the start of the entrepreneurial bug that I had. The funny thing is I have yet to make a business deal on a golf course, especially in the digital age. Like, every deal I've done has been just like this on a Zoom call. Like, that's how we've made business deals. So if there's anybody out there who wants to meet me for a golf and business chat, I would love to fulfill my 7-year-old dream of signing a business deal on a golf course one day. That's
the goal. This is like the myth about meeting a woman. You do that when you are doing your grocery shopping. That's the best place to meet, because well, good luck. I've been doing my grocery shopping for the past 50 years. I haven't met a single person in a grocery store ever.
Yeah.
So you're right. So at the age of 7, you knew that you knew enough about business deals being made on the golf course.
Yeah.
And you wanted to play golf because of business.
Yep. Business and Tiger Woods.
Business and Tiger Woods. But how that means that it must have started even before the age of 7, because by the age of 7, you knew that this is what you wanted to do, then you understood. So where did you get that initial bug?
Well, now you're branching into parts of my life that I don't even remember anymore. If I'm thinking back to like the very, very first entrepreneurial thing I ever did in my life, it was, we had a plum tree in our front yard. And I would pick all the plums and walk around to the neighbor's house and sell them bags of plums. Like, if we're really going all the way back, like, that's the first memory I have of doing some kind of commerce.
So what was it that appealed to you? Was it the cash you were picking up, or was it the fact that you were actually getting people to do something that you wanted to do?
At that age, it was that I could sell something and turn that something into Legos. Like, as a little kid at that age, I was like, hey, I can pick the plums, I can sell them, and I can take that money to the store and buy Legos. So it was profit.
It's the conversion of, you know, doing something that converts to something else and then something else. So that's the appeal.
Yeah.
Well, that's what you're doing now.
Yeah.
So it's not the money.
No, not at all. No, not at all. It's the itch to like create something.
That's it. Yeah.
And do something. And then, yeah, the money, like, it scratches my hobby itches. Like, it's fun. Like, my hobbies have never changed throughout my entire life. Like, I've been a golfer since I was 7 years old. And like, that's an important lesson in life for any entrepreneurs out there, is like, become the person you want to be, because money doesn't make you bad or it doesn't make you good. It just takes who you are and makes who you are more.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're so right. That's how it is. I mean, I asked this question because it's a true entrepreneurs, money is never the objective. So somebody just chasing after money, that's they're gonna keep chasing. But it's that passion to create something out of nothing, make an impact, having a vision, and those are the kinds of things that drive people to do these things. This is great, Dan. Thank you very much. And I loved your story about why you wanted to play golf at the age of 7. That's great. So tell us, how can people reach you?
Yeah, I'm very active on LinkedIn. I might be the only Dan Mazaris on there. It's not the most common name in the world. So I'm very active on LinkedIn. If you want to reach out to my agency directly, it's scalestrategy.com with a K, SKALE strategy.com. Yeah, but LinkedIn's definitely the best way to get a hold of me. I'm very active there. Respond to all of my DMs as quickly as I possibly can. And I just love providing value to that community. So you'll see me commenting on people's posts all the time and making fun of other people and having a good time.
Yeah. Great. Thank you, Dan. This was great. And thank you for being a guest today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Happy to be here.
And this brings us to the end of another episode, and I'll see you on the next one.
If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the episode, and share it with someone you think would benefit from it too.